Greetings, this is VLP podcaster Douglas Brennelson, welcoming you to the February 2008 VLP Poetry Slam podcast, recorded live at the Coffee Shop Gallery downtown Vermilion, South Dakota. This evening's sacrificial poet and honored guest from Omaha is renowned slam poet Matt Mason, who hosted the slam and read 8 original slam poems, including When the Baby Falls Asleep, We Celebrate, and Code Orange, which will be featured here in this podcast. And now on to round one.
All right, thank you. It's always good to be up here in Vermilion. You guys have got a good slam and have produced a lot of good folks, not just Elliot Harmon, but who's come down to Omaha a lot in the past few years. Well, not since he moved to California, the bastard, but used to come down to Omaha a lot. So I love coming up here. And you pack a nice coffee shop, so it's a good thing. My wife comes back into the light, arms high, and I jump up, making sure not to creak the chair. We take off our shoes and we dance. We are good people, shipwrecked on the shores of this strange island, fearing the drums far, far through the trees. We tiptoe across the beach, TV quiet, as if all the world must whisper, must dare not wake her, must bow to this new pharaoh whose yokes we wear across our throats, this thunder infant with wrath grown as evening stretches into the fury and the fussiness that nursing at the breast can only sometimes abate. And if she then wakes, if the door creaks just so loud, if it's you who made the toilet seat crack like a gunshot, only moments after she went down, and the woman who swore before Jesus to love you forever looks at you with all the flames of hell in her eyes, may God have mercy on you. My wife and I rent nothing but horror movies now. Huddle next to the television, trying not to guffaw out loud as these actors face aliens and disembowelments. Things we might have feared in another life. But let's see Freddy or Jason or King freaking Kong make you fear like when you only meant to ease the door open. Thinking how beautiful her little closed-eyed dream face is, and instead see her sit up. Try not to scream as her eyes rotate to snap on your mortal form. Oh ha! Godzilla! Take a number, giant bug. This monster is so monstrous, we don't even try to run. I do love them, though. They're very kind. So anyway, this poem is for my wife, but I only read it when she's not here, because it's called Ode to My Wife's Panties. Roses on silk, red eye patch, you mask too tiny to disguise, I am on the bed. Neruda's Every Day You Play on the open page between my legs. This is the poem closing, I want to do with you what spring does with the cherry trees. And my wife walks through, wearing only you and the baby nursing on her chest. Remember panties, remember pregnancy, remember last year where biology itself was birth control, and I would pull your smooth strings down her soft skin across the kiss of ankle bones to drop you by the bed, the couch, the sink, the car, the cash register, the beautifully trimmed lawn at the state capitol. Your touch sweet floor play, you bright flag flown for me to find comfort in. And before that, remember honeymoon. Remember the drama of arguments about something we've forgotten. But I still remember after seeing you like a wink, like a secret signal that all is clear, that this is time to make up and to kiss. Oh, panties. I just want to be forgiven, to forgive that way. But she comes to bed and there are no raised voices, no slammed doors, all regrets left in some other house. We new parents, we just haven't slept enough. Not last night, or the night before, or last week, or last month, or. I reach quietly to touch you, fall asleep, my palm against your cheek. Of the Jedi, the follow-up to that first poem. Because it takes a heart like a sun to hold to the bright side of the Force. When you saw every day in high school how it's the Sith who get all the chicks. Just watch Jedi Luke kisses who in the movies? His sister. And you tell me, ladies, a towering powerhouse in black leather comes chatting you up at the bar with a voice like James Earl Jones's. No matter how he turns out underneath that outfit, I defy you to claim to me in 2 hours that you are still wearing panties. Because love really is like Star Wars. With the earliest episodes being so insecure, you want to pretend they just never happened. All that inanity of you babbling about love, like our love by the lake on Naboo, where there was only our love. You, left hanging out after school with salamander-faced caricatures, their strong hearts stumbling on oversized feet. We, nice guy geeks. We hurl ourselves to Dagobah to study under a wise green Muppet, or drive to Chicago to see Mark Smith at the Green Mill, where Sarah McKinstry Brown, who hasn't called you back since a long time ago and far, far away, is featuring with her poetry. You gotta be strong. You gotta be patient. You gotta realize that there is some shit so tightly wound up in us that even Yoda is scared to tell you. You have to face it yourself. You have to finally understand how the darkest enemy isn't the emperor, or the quarterback, or the poet who wins the slam, or Darth Assface, or her. The darkest enemy is the one deep in some metaphorical tree trunk wearing your face under all his masks. And yes, he needs a hug. Yes, he needs you to gush about how you know he's still good and not give up, never waver until the universe is set back right so that when you find yourself dancing on the moon with a bunch of goddamn teddy bears, you can answer, Sarah, I'm not here to take you away. I just drove out to say, hi, I miss you, baby. And see what happens once the credits stop ascending and the lights wash back up. Actions on the protest against immigrants, April 14th, 2007. You drive by for the same reason you go to a zoo or turn on TV, to gawk at the baboons, to chuckle at the yahoos. Not expecting on a sunny afternoon in Omaha, Nazi flags and salutes. This is Dodge Street, the main street. This is your hometown, grade school, high school, first kiss, land where your father died, heartland home, and the hicks you came to heckle, yes, they're here as promised. But you don't see them, or whatever might be written on their little signs. You don't even roll down your window to give them the finger as planned. The window stays up. You stare through it at the two guys nobody's standing within 10 feet of. Two guys waving swastikas on flagpoles as if it were their football team. You just keep driving,
Your only show of protest against protest suddenly feeling sharper. Your own hate melting into nothing you ever want to see written out in your own hand. Because when you call down hatred, that's one thing that will always respond, and almost never as you planned. It's called Code Orange. It's not always the little boy who cries wolf. Sometimes the wolf cries wolf and points away. We now go live to the White House press secretary. Ms. Secretary, Americans seem confused about where this war on terror is going. At a press conference to explain the war on terror a while back, former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld was quoted as saying, "There are known knowns. These are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we know we don't know, but there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we don't know we don't know." Can you explain this kind of explanation for us? Yeah. Duct tape your door shut. We are on Code Orange. Code Orange, people. Blue skies no matter. There is anthrax. Somewhere. Somebody said something about smallpox. Wherever. An unnamed man reportedly said something big was coming down. Eventually. A man said people are going to die. People are going to die. Americans are going to die. Officials are quoted as saying things. Officials are quoted as saying, "Hurry up, seal yourself in a Ziploc bag, in a lead wall box, in a hole in the earth, in prayer to our God," because sources suggest it, we're not scared enough. And if we don't get a little more hysterical, it's the terrorists who will win, because sources report it could be any day, hour, minute, second. Duck could be any metropolis, small town, farmstead, or possibly somewhere else. For God's sake, people, there are experts telling us we're not safe. We're not safe. Now do what we say and nobody gets hurt. There's fear out past your walls. There's fear itself blowing against the plastic sheeting and the bars of gray tape. There is so much to fear. We have to fight them, kill them, cripple them for Jesus. Amen. It's not always a little boy who cries wolf. Sometimes the wolf cries wolf. And it's not always the wolf our little boys are sent out to kill.
Okay, this is entitled Why I Walk the Way I Do, and kind of just explains I walk everywhere with my headphones on, and I kind of notice myself, you know, laughing, kind of zoning out and not paying attention. And I probably look pretty crazy, but this kind of just describes everything that's going on in my head with it. You know me, I'm that cackling ring thoroughly enveloped in headphones, gliding like Richard Corey over cracked sidewalk fields. Side-splitting laughter in my eyes, tear-squirting wonder gargling around my mouth, cold to the touch are these padded passports from silence. And I don't just use them to avoid potential high, how are you, stop and chats, no time, no time. My soul, brimming with lust, escapes through clefts and staffs and bars and I'm listening to blue-green shadows holding hands in smoky hole-in-the-wall romance. Bawling minors swooping through my intimate attention span, packing a buzz like dragonflies. Kicks and snares and hats trading blows, angels and devils balancing out the shoulders of builders. And there goes my favorite song again. The one where the trumpet bows out to the robust, amorous saxophone, like a king passing the throne to the humble prince. And you can tell by the latitude of my jagged smirk what's venturing into my head. Here's that part of the solo that prostrates my quivering jaw. It sounds like this friend I used to have but lost in my own dissonant progression across my still life. And there goes my favorite song again. The one with the weepy slides over golden frets under bent, wavy, diving cries, happy as a baby dreaming about laughter. And if the batteries die, and my machine flatlines, my stride loses poise, and I'm an ugly, sullen, sigh-beaten path without a stone to mark my perimeter, swallowed up in hungry desolation, lonely, lost, icy silence. But if not, uncontrolled giggles seep from my parched throat when certain vibrations arise, hammering my eardrums like Max Roach. And there goes my favorite song again, the one where the MC rattles out a big bang idea that spackles the roof of my neuron nucleus, shut in quiet contentment, thinking too much, too fast. Cyclone rhythmic banters of a rapid-worded syntactician, and I can do that too, I swear. And that one there? That's the sound of a jittery first kiss, nervously comfortable, trotting out on an uneasy limb. And that one there? That's the sound of an echo of a crashing wind chime under weathered spring gusts, cutting the clay free from the fishing line noose. I see all this inside my headphones, my music chambers, warming my aura with chamber music. Oh, and that noise there, I almost forgot, is the loveliest noise of all, so beautiful it could only be a her. It's the sound of a tingling spine waltzed over with adoring fingertips. That's somebody's song, somebody's secret. A tickling feather in the dark, a diatonic promise, a diamond-filled pair of arms. Her sound, the one that sounds like her and all her jeweled company. She's the better half of a gilded harmony wrung out from a dream. That sound I can taste, smell, touch, and see. I call it fantasy incarnate. It's the glow of my dynamic pulse skipping over sidewalk cracks. Thank you.
In my final paper about the old man in the sea, and I'll explain how the long journey represents a similar spiritual yearning towards something just beyond the horizon. And I'll explain that when the old man, Ahab, finally catches the white whale and dies with it, it symbolizes how empty spiritual journeys are. Because if I don't fail, I'll finally graduate. And when I do, I'll have to go on and get a job or an MBA or a PhD or something. And then I'll cut my hair and start to wear a suit. And that will be the end of that. Because my hair will fall out from the stress of yelling at my secretary or waiting for the foursome of retirees to find their balls in the tall grass. Plus, I'll be flaccid and impotent from mixing Xanax, caffeine, and booze to get through the stressful day. Everything will culminate in my buying a German sports car and tearing like hell down the highway while yelling at the little Michael Schumachers in the back seat to watch the damn DVD before I pull over and beat their asses. But they know I won't, because we're making great time. They'll shut up anyway, because they know if they do, I'll buy them another PlayStation game. Hell, I'll buy them 1,000 PlayStation games and a big fucking TV to watch that MTV crap on. Anything but books. That way, they'll fail American Lit.
Not all that familiar with spoons. The Georgia Guidestones in Elbert County and the motivational poster at the Prion Factory says, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. I'm waiting for someone to maintain me in a Ranger Rick costume, and I'll say, this is only fair if you squeeze me to death inside a giant tulip because I did that with bees when I was 9. I recycle even though there was a medieval warm period, 1000 to 1300 AD, and a little ice age, 1300 to 1800 AD. You hide all the spoons because knives are far superior, and you want them to dominate all utensils. You use all your forks to mark vortexes for your fascist group to hoard, so in your mind, the forks aren't forks anymore and are disqualified. The knife fairy visits you. She makes knives out of hidden forks because they remind her of ribs. The sudden appearance of hidden spoons makes her assume all forks have been transformed into things that aren't forks anymore. It doesn't help that your forks aren't hidden or forks anymore. She's not all that familiar with spoons. No knife is ever made again. Isn't it ironic? I can't decide on my synchronicity. What did the Jughead in a bumper car figurine my brother put into the blender look like to me after my sledding accident? I threw Jughead in the air for fun, and it hit my grandma in the back while she was frying bacon. She said, oh, it was the saddest thing. The blender must have said something, too. I sawed free the thumbs of the California raisin figurine that were stuck to its head. Does this make me more desirable to others? There were these neon Amazon women figurines in 70s-style clothing who had to stand up to work at monitors. I thought of them during lice checks at school. The nurse would come to our classrooms and examine our hair with tongue depressors. She said, "Keep working, keep working." Even now, my head sometimes feels like an extinct mouth. Someone will pass legislation and snip my brain to fix.
Skinwalker. Within me, people find solace. Without me, weak people die. Holding me tightly, strong people weaken. Emptying me, people are not yet fulfilled. Cause of joy, of sorrow. Unfathomable deaths reached within my finite limits of comfort. Companionship and existence crushed within a single fist that holds me gently until I die. My first kiss enlivens the meek and brings down the strong-willed piece by piece. An equal footing, shifting rapidly to swallow you whole, your entire life hanging in my jaws while you still cling to them. My skin weakens on each step you take, allowing myself to be crushed underfoot until rising suddenly to pull you down on top of me, cut you open to bleed you from me, and snatch back the life I lend you more and more each night. Enjoy me while you can, until the very thought invokes a cringe through the tears that fall upon my thin shell, cooling on my skin and running out upon your hand, clenched yet around me. You will never release me until you finish me. My will breaks yours, no questions asked, taking over your mind and body until I eat you alive, inside out and from the outside in, to remain, the mark hanging upon your neck for all to see.
Speech, Tidal Wave. He closes his eyes and sees blackness. There is no color behind his eyelids, only dark and flashes of light, like ivory into noiselessness. Nothing is there, only a breath and then a song. A melody played full chorus in his ears. There is an orchestral ballad, a rhythmic strum, accurate to an unknown reference that is the ear where it strums from. Trance are his thoughts as he pours onto the soul of a sixth string. Pale and white, he sees a canvas in the sky, notes with no boundaries to lose them. He's a child releasing the string of a red balloon. He's chasing a kite for the sake of getting lost, not caring if he is found, because the sound of his voice carries through the haze of cigarette smoke and the bottleneck trees stemming from the concrete sidewalk where he sits playing guitar for no one. Singing to himself in tongues that are pure and foreign to the silent passersby, a few throwing change into the jar before him, eyes diverted, his eyes closed, seeing only blankness on their faces. He serenades the streets tonight, keeping time with the traffic lights and tides, the face of the moon illuminating everything. His song illuminates everything else. Sitting on the wall separating him from the sand and ocean, I am a stone for his casting, a stream in his eyes, ripples in his breath. There's a cloud in the sky, and the water in his jug smells like whiskey. And the change in his jar will keep him warm when the seasons change and he returns to Balboa Park, where he perfects his song, singing to the winter winds, the percussion of palm trees whispering in the backdrop of a city. He imagines a tidal wave breaking on the rocks below sunset cliffs, the splash of water rising like diamonds, rinsing his body clean, then drying in the sun, leaving a trail of salt matted to his eyelash.
Come on, let me be the big dog for today. You take my shoes and emotions and see how hard the sole of the shoe is. Let me be the big dog. Come on, let me be the big dog for today. You're soft as a flower and I'm hard and cold as ice. You come so emotional with a sensitive conversation and then I come so aggressive, not knowing the words I speak will hurt you. After the hurtful words I speak out loud, I brush my shoulders off and head to my big dogs, my homies, my peeps. And I didn't realize how crappy I left your emotional heart. So how does it feel? Emotional, hurtful, lonely, unappreciated, or maybe clueless to why I'm acting this way? Well, I'm an immature, selfish, inconsiderate ass. And my feelings, It's the last thing I want to feel. Because my life, on the other hand, is wonderful. I'm so caught up on myself, I won't even take the time to make you happy. I'm so selfish, I won't even take off my blindfold and see I'm putting you on an emotional ride with my I don't give a fuck attitude. The big dog isn't so cool when you're in my shoes. Damn, I wish I was the big dog.
It's been a whole month since I got up here and yelled at you people. Anyway, this is called Sneak Preview. My mother moved out of town yesterday. All her least useful shit and household messes did not. So here we are, my brother and I, cleaning her somewhat empty dwelling and gathering her things, and then I realize this is exactly what it will be like when she dies. I'll be in her home, minus all the her, wondering where all this is supposed to go. My brother will show up then too, very late and half hungover, as is his wont. I'll remark again about how it still seems like her room, though she will have given it up for a different reason. And I'm sure I'll be waiting for her to come back like all the other times she disappeared to parts unknown. She won't. That's the part they leave out of the movie trailer.
And now for round two of the Poetry Slam.
Alright, it's a three-parter. Who judges what for? Cold cylinder pressed against my forehead. Daylight's over. Hold broken over my thoughts, body, mind. But not my soul. How can you have what you will never belong to, you fool? Unwind the threads, break the seal. Jolt my mind, indescribable. Puff, hiss, smoke, strand release of supercharged 7-Up. Settle to sweet syllables as I write my own, yellowed, silver, and black. Wash off the torrent and desktop glow, open another dimension, one word. Click, word, drown down oceans and music, ever clear flavors, right? Novel ideas, idyllic comments on the world? No, I write my own, yellowed, silver, and black. Relax, deep sighs across darkened house, smelling slightly wet, moaning on to itself, society's death blanked from my mind. So quit looking at what you will never know, a deeper meaning may not exist. Crawl inside my head, take what you will. Therapy exists at night, under silvered and yellow, silvered and black yellowed light, writing my soul. Forget mechanics and theories, forget any semblance of rhyme, rhythm, simile, metaphor, write from the soul. Part two, require for those who companion. Do I have to beat this through the soft ignorance of your brain? Sacrifice my meaning of whatever meaning you wish and focus bullshit mentioned multiple, so pay attention, damn it. There is no fucking meaning here, except what you create. How can you have what will never belong to you? I write my own novel ideas on the world. So quit looking at what you will never know. I told you twice and it's killing me. I don't care what you take away here. I told you to forget mechanics and theories, but metaphors don't work on you. Moron, the devil is a worm, i.e. metaphor glossed over in wake of hurry. So I'll line up the fence post cans, and you knock them down, sugar. My devil exists in whatever I wish. I don't write for a grade, a star, or a pat on the back. Wake up, for the devil alarm clock is ringing from its throne. Catch the illusion. Sound it out slowly and think. And take what you will, but do not complain when you can't sift out a meaning. God gave you a brain to create evolution and think for yourself. I can't take your hand and lead you through. You do that on your own. Watch the word placement in double entendre. Catch the illusion or grab a dictionary. Spoon feed me the answers when you're done, but watch the grammar for everything, implied or not, by the degree of your ruse or the ruse of your degree. Am I the blind man here, or are you? I see time not as a linear function, but as a Medusa waiting in the wings to mirror itself. For double effect, read above the lines and add your own periods. A reference to return too often, for it is often best in life to compare what lies in wait behind you, yet to be discovered in the trillion waters of what life you call it, when a paragraph break ends all thought and contemplation necessary to understand. Think about it, and the numbers 48 and 49, 18 and 19 make sense. But where to begin? Delve deeper than syntax, grammar, and that all-important, all-encompassing message that must exist, huh? Somewhere among the letters, words, periods, that ever elusive comma lies my true message, which I don't even care for you to find. Apparently you do try the surface, not to get your feet wet as you think they will explode in a tidal wave present. Part 3. Companion poem for those who require it. Well, maybe I do think a little above the national sixth grade level on some aspects. I know I'm not perfect and do not care to be. My grammar is atrocious along with my spelling in certain cases, but certainly these small issues cannot kill the message present under all those layers. People who take away something different from what is implied, so what? Art is about the individual experience in which each person has their own. Some may see a devil in the details, cliche I know, while others see an alarm clock. I refuse to edit part one because it says what I wish to say, simply, opaquely, and well. The whole poem is about people twisting a poet's words to find their own meaning, then preaching that their interpretation of what the poet was saying all along. Every stanza mentioned this concept. Lines 2 through 6, 15 through 24, 17 through 18, 21 through 25 touch on this subject. How much more direct can I get than crawl inside my head, take what you will? My meaning is that you may never know a poet's real meaning. Look harder, people.
Okay. This is entitled We're Waiting, and it's for my mother, who's lately kind of just fallen through a spell of misfortune. Awaken. Free your sagacity from smothering, muddy, exhausted, nightmarish fevers burrowed in your comforters with the rest of the invisible bedbugs. I will help you up, but what's a helping hand that doesn't wane when your toes meet the ground? I thought it was going to be a good year, too. I thought that, think that, and won't let you stare through 10 months in silent sobs over what happened, while what happens isn't adding up to more than a dumb mattress, some magic distraction. Not once have you shoved madness backwards. Notice your sparkling support. Worried, heartbroken insomniacs waiting for you. That infectious laugh. That foundation rumbling sneeze. That colorful, lively, open-armed voice. But what is it that you need to keep your paper frame from ripping, folding, or catching fire? One tug at the paper swan's tail and she's alive, cupped in my palms. When I tug, hands spring up like the willowy gymnast, ruminate over trophies and ribbons from times of being a sculptor, a symmetrical composer, genetic genius. See, I'm proud too, care. Like their favorite, most requested, unstinting, empathetic, luminous nurse, provide, protect, love, and teach like the proud, flattering, refined mother. And if you ever need to hear it, that reminder I want draped across your skyline, I couldn't love who I come from more. From Middleton to the Memphis Inn to the admittance, say good riddance, they've past like yesterday's, and it might not be all right. But you can't tell with the shades drawn and eyes glued shut. We're waiting. We're waiting. Unclench your persistent saddening and filter it through fingers like sand, like it's made of billions and billions of manageable little things. One tug at the paper swan's tail and she's alive, cupped in my palms. When I tug, tug back, for I'm made of the same flimsy material, creased at the heart. Thank you.
All right, this was originally entitled Manifestation Apocalypse. Tonight I'm going to call it Manifestation American. And in the streets there are hollow shells of men running. And in the universities, young scholars have turned their heads to stone armies. The ROTC has shotgunned a bill to pass pipe bombs amongst world leaders. Oil tar to be pumped into the Dakotas. Refineries for every citizen. Coal coalitions in Washington and elsewhere. Canada could use the money. Panama could use more honey. America's lost. All bets off. Recession plague in the middle class. Top 10% send investments to China. Land of the growing communist brothers and sisters. All welcome. Welcome all to Arizona and New Mexico. Come see the Great Wall. Come see American ingenuity. Come freaks to the circus. Come children to beds, heads gently on pillows, dreaming the American. And in the country, farmers are collecting arms for the revolution, and the housewives are busy with other affairs, and their sons are on the computers shouting pillars of prayer, fingers trembling, jihad, jihad, daughter at the television, survivors on, she is already lost. And the political scene is a nightmare. Eisenhower is dead, Bush's own legacy, a volcano belly flopped into the deserted sands of Navajo, cactus nail guns and opposition rattlesnakes, venom of the mind, it is fear into the veins of the American junkie, lurking in the shadows below towers of steel rustings, steel Goliaths and a concrete Golgotha. All cities built on dust will fall, dust and sand cities wash away with the cyclone, twirling in the wasteland and ghost streets and ghost bars and ghost cemeteries, cemeteries for the old and dead and dying, where the grass grows brown like it is dry and the wind is harsh and the sky is thin and the sun is bright like visions of God before the apocalypse, telling me the king of May is dead and soon centaurs and goblins of industry will trample me and I may claim fault for the fall of man. Blooming mouth, I am a springtime shower in Prague before Stalin. Sweeping green across red curtains of old USSR, I speak so I may be faultless, though not free of fault, I am not speechless. Because I am the King of May reincarnate, pulling flowers out of the ground by their petals, shaking their roots clean, examining their holy thorns and spires and tendrils, delicately coiled in the sun, shining dew-covered like bright halos. And in the universities, they read 1,000-year-old poetry. And all the old dead poets are old and dead and gone. And still students rage protests in the mines, feeding fires with textbooks, silent in the dormitories, the brightest stars dimming behind storm clouds. We've all seen what good it does to fight. And the crisis in Darfur bleeds into the red soil of Africa. And the Congo of Iraq and Israel also, and our brothers in Afghanistan and on the streets of the American city. And the whole damn world is crying out between twisted lips. And the minds of men are building networks of terror. And the bombs of Washington are aimed ready to end it. Trenches of foot soldiers buried in Arlington already after mission accomplished. And the human disease has reached epidemic proportions, infecting the wounds of the scarred and still living. Many of us still thin and ready-eyed and tired of campaign trails and the ones in our arms, tired of the sound, so we turn our minds idle and smooth running. But the elections are turning heads in the East and elsewhere. Che Guevara had his rebellion, whereas ours, Kennedy, was assassinated. Why must peace perish for progress? Who will wash these obscene oaths from our eye sockets, pulling shut the shades to our skulls, still rattled and dizzy, the frames of our bodies bending in the nuclear winds of our creation, like Mayflowers in April? But soon bending leads to breaking, and we bend because it is bending we have learned. But soon bending leads to breaking, and the tempered hooves of fate are only faint now in the distance. So many of us to repent, and so much space here in heaven, we should live there always.
This is a robbery. All robberies are types of ecclesiastical districts. The man who's counting with his head to the ground, his shoulders feel like a suspended apricot. His breathing sounds like a mothball larger on the inside. Once he tasted his friend Tom in the Berlin Wall. Now he's looking on the floor for David Bowie's left iris, but he only sees a baby listening for her mother's voice. The voice looks like the mashing of sea grapes. What can save us now? John Franklin Rogers with his signed boxcar Willie Whistle from Branson, Missouri. One of the robbers wrapped a Bible in the funny papers and placed it at a construction site. The woman with the oscillating skirt knows and whispers, "Let's ankle." The robber presses his cheek to a brick and checks the sealed vault. But my breasts only spray milk in the shower, and that hardly counts. The one-armed man shakes his giant number one foam finger and says, "The blue train of Confucius tunnels underneath us full of worth, an earthquake, and this time he's right." The old woman rolls just in time to see her only love mouth, "I'm dumping you." The old woman smiles. Vincent Price talks through the robber's arm. The vault is open, and the Apple Kid runs by the sagging windows, calling her uncle a quasar. Of course, the sensitive robber pours lemon juice onto his arm. If the arm had eyes, they'd look sewn open, as the teller sitting in his cage after the selective rat of antiquity evolved out of existence. He asks again, "What is the exchange rate?" The security camera sniffs for lateral shrinkage. The whistle sounds unclinically rapturous. John Franklin writes Boxcar Willie under Boxcar Willie's signature. And everyone in this room will be a robber someday.
Okay, this is, lose my voice. This is called Alone. This is a fantasy, so yeah. I waited. Days, nights, and weeks. Lonely nights I spent alone. But now you're here. Here with me. Now it's time to take care of me. Don't say anything. Just touch me right there. And listen to the sweet melody I moan in your ear. Now my clothes are itching to come off. My body anxiously waiting. Please take them off. It's obviously my body is calling. The way you love me, it's hard to stay mute. The way you handle me, please make me louder. I love when you take control right there in that spot, piercing my nails in your back. You like it. So you aim deeper in the right spot. I'm going to reach my max sooner than I thought. The thickness of you feels extra thick as you play with the right spot with the head of my desire. You start to hear thunder as I come closer and closer. I see your eyes, you're almost there too. The tension between us reaching our climax. I open my eyes to see I'm still alone.
Okay, this is called the eulogy for B.T. Bruniger. The sky was there. That was the sky. A large sky when he stepped off the train into the drama of nature with jagged edges to kill a man. The man came from this horizontal land, and his thoughts were such, long and steady, with subtle bumps lacking leaps and steep angles. His grandfather had been a novelist, his father a historian. The man, he was a horse trader. He bought them, then bred them, and sold them. He had had no time for sons, only horses. This was not at all an unhealthy man. Do not think that he did not love fine horses, like other men love fine meals or good books, or that he was not intelligent. He could have been a poet or surgeon, but he was not unsatisfied at all. Two things gave him the greatest pleasure: to embark upon a distant journey, and relaxing in his vineyard in the evenings. Thus, you could say he was a simple man, but he was sharp and cold in business. Never had he lived a poor man's life, neither was he ignorant of hard work. His hands were scarred, but his chest long grown soft. He became much richer than his father. B.T. Bruniger was not an evil man. Imagine he's in heaven now. He shall not be canonized, nor shall we, but I imagine he is quite content. The talk was that the thin air had killed him. No, he was only 66 that day, and though it had been years since he had had to work, those who knew him knew he was a robust man. The doctors say it was a blood clot, one that had probably formed in his leg as he sat on the train on the long ride west. It reached his heart just as he stepped off the train and saw that sky. A witness at the station reported he had looked up at the sky, then fallen. His hand grabbed his chest, and he had died. That was on a still day in Montana. There were very few people at the station. The man who'd stepped off before him recalled that he just fell and died and said nothing. Most men have no words in their hearts at the end. He was buried in that cemetery. He had had no sons or brothers, and he owed everything to the college. Though he was not a very rich man. Did I mention how fine his horses were?
Not my best night. I got up and read a poem about missing my mommy, and everybody left. I'm giving up by this point. So, this is called I'd Show You. I wish for your sake that I could draw, paint, etch, or digitally record the smell of paint fumes, diesel exhaust, welding smoke, and toluene, or make a movie about the path of one tiny carcinogenic molecule, one particle of guaranteed cancerous cell mutation, flying out of an exhaust pipe, passing down the esophagus, tootling on into the bronchial tubes, turning its hips a little to shimmy past the capillary turnstile, into the bloodstream, into the brain of a man who hates his job because he should. Then show you the faces of 10 others who feel the same, none of whom can afford not to die in a war, none of whom can go to the fucking doctor, none of whom have a nest egg, all of whom are represented by a bunch of zeros and ones in the mainframe of a quasi-functional office PC. If I could, I'd show you that shit. Peace.
And the first prize goes to Taylor G. And he reads his victory poem, Verdina State.
This is about a place I've spent a lot of weekends called the Verdina State. The beauty of this place, the solace of its present, resides in its vastly, radically dissimilar future. One must revel, revel, revel in its diversity of life. Let one's lungs swell with free air. Bathe in rivers of wordless absolution. Touch the clouds at the tops of trees that are armed with nothing more than your respect. Step softly, I bid you. The grass will kiss your feet with its many supple tongues. Endless vines will entangle your soul. You'll bear witness to the unseen wiles of Animalia. But yea, these things are fleeting. The last thing you'll feel is the sorrow of remembering a time when this land had never touched a city.
And that was the February VLP Poetry Slam Podcast. This is Douglas Brennelson, and I'll see you again next month for the March 2008 VLP Poetry Slam.